You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, November 21st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, director Jeff Orlowski of the film Chasing Ice. An amazing documentary following the photographer James Balog as he heads to where the great glaciers live and documents their dying as a visual proof of global warming. Also on the program today, Lyndon McMahon, Lloyd Blankenfein, horrible people. Benghazi, Benghazi. It won't be the Watergate that Lindsey Graham had hoped would happen. John McCain, Michelle Malkin, all of them. Getting very close to Thanksgiving, which of course means that we're getting very close to Black Market. What not Black Market? Black Friday. And that could mean problems for Walmart. They certainly seem to be worried. Deepak Chopra, big liberal, against any type of grand bargain. I love it. And, of course, we will take your IMs and phone calls today. I will be offering advice on how to deal with your right-wing relatives at Thanksgiving. And I'll read a piece, I guess, I don't know who wrote it at Breitbart, giving the advice for what to do with your liberal relatives. And stunning and how unfunny it is. And finally, also, new regulations released today regarding Obamacare were officially released today, I guess. These, of course, will not take effect for another year and change. But the Obama administration issued new rules Tuesday that require insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing medical conditions. This is just an official release of these rules. That was not a surprise. It also began putting in place the HHS. New limits on how much insurers can vary their premiums, allowing insurers only the ability to charge older patients three times more than younger customers. In some states, it's a 5-to-1 ratio. Regulations also bar insurers from charging six customers a higher premium. Everyone who buys insurance through the newly created exchanges, which are going to be in the states, rather than getting it through an employer, will be combined into one large risk pool, meaning insurance companies can spread out their risks more broadly. That's pretty good. Another regulation released Tuesday begins to flesh out the definition of essential benefits. There are 10 categories of essential benefits, and it originally the HHS was going to allow states to fill those benefits out. Now it seems that there's going to be some type of federal standard. And for at least kids, things like dental and eye care will be included. So that's really good. There is some suspicion that premiums are going to go up in some cases, but that insurance companies won't be able to sort of load up for one-offs. In other words, that they have to gradually increase rates rather than 5 years down the road dumping it all on you, the 25% rate increase. That'll be the next battle. Once everybody has insurance at that point, once we've established, and of course everybody won't, but a lot more Americans will. Once we've established that health insurance is a right in this country, we can then hopefully get to the argument of what's the most efficient way of providing it for everybody. And we know what the answer to that is. It's a Medicare for all system. But we may be a way off for that. Who knows? All right, in the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Orlowski. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jeff Orlowski. He is the producer, director, and cinematographer of a new film entitled Chasing Ice. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Sam. It's great to be on.
I got to tell you, I want to start off by saying that I watched your film on my computer. And I want to apologize because it is a beautiful film, and it's one that I was sick. I couldn't, whatever. I have my excuses, but it's a beautiful film, and it'd be fantastic to see it on a wide screen. And people, at least on the East Coast, have a day to go and do that. We'll talk about where it's being released, but Tell me where you got the idea for the film. It follows a photographer, James Balog, on what is really an obsession for this guy.
Yeah, James, he's an incredible photographer, and he had this idea to do time lapses of glaciers, and it was from that genesis and from that, you know, that singular idea that he decided to build this camera system. And we traveled around the world. We installed them in Iceland and Greenland and Alaska. And I just had the very good fortune of meeting him before this project got started. And I was on the very first trip to Iceland, and I joined him, and we were filming it. And we weren't planning on making a movie. We just wanted to document what he was doing. And every single time we went back out in the field, you know, more crazy stuff happened. And every time we went back and started collecting the data from the camera boxes, we saw that these glaciers were changing much faster than we expected, and we had the visual proof. We had the documentation of what was happening to the glaciers. Your comments about seeing it on the laptop, yeah, these landscapes are so huge. When there are places in Greenland where the glaciers are 5 miles wide, and you know, it kind of hurts when I know people are seeing it on the laptop because it, like, that's how the film is going to get out there. But we really designed this for the big screen. We wanted people to see it on the big screen. We did a screening in London in a room for 950 people. The screen was probably, I don't know, 50 feet tall, something like that. And it was the first time the film actually felt close to what it really feels like in real life. Because, like, wrapping your head around how big these landscapes are is really, really tough. We really tried to communicate scale as much as possible in the film.
Well, it's a beautifully shot film. So wait, now, so you didn't set out to make a documentary. Were you out there as part of his project, Well, why don't you tell people? Let's start with this. Tell people what I mean. The Extreme Ice Survey turned out to be this photographer's sort of. I think he seemed to sort of like perceive it and as his life's mission at this point. And like you say, he was measuring the death, I guess, in some respects, of these glaciers. And so you went out there as part of that project?
Yeah, that's how it started. And, you know, just to be clear, James himself, he's not an environmental activist. His background is in geomorphology. He studied, you know, how landscapes changed over time. And he was approaching this both from a photographer perspective and then also from this historical, you know, geologic perspective. And he, you know, there was a period where he was very skeptical of climate change, whether or not it was real. And so here's a guy who comes from a very different background, who saw that these landscapes were changing and wanted to just document it, wanted to see, you know, what exactly is going on, what does it look like. So he's coming from a very, very, you know, different, unique perspective in terms of what he was trying to capture. It wasn't like a mission to get environmental activism out there and to prove what was going on. It was really just a curiosity for wanting to observe and his pursuit as an artist and as a photographer to show something new, you know, because for years and years, the debate around climate change is in facts and figures and numbers and statistics, and you hear both sides arguing left and right as to what's going on, and it's really, really hard to wrap your head around the science, and there's so much misinformation about the issue out there. And so James wanted to try and make something new and visual that would, you know, not necessarily end the debate, but he wanted to provide something new that people could look at in a different way and can understand in a different way. So, you know, the Extreme Ice Survey got started. I got on board, was just starting to travel with him. And we were shooting video, like I said, just for, you know, promotional things and YouTube videos and stuff like that. We just kept traveling out there. And I first went with him to Iceland, and then he invited me to Greenland and Alaska. And it was about a year and a half into the project when we finally had all the raw material in place and all the video footage. We had, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of time-lapse images at that point probably, and we knew we had the materials to go ahead and start to make a film. At this point, in the end, we ended up with over 400 hours of video footage, and there are over 1 million photographs in the time-lapse record that James has captured from glaciers around the world. And the thing is, they all tell the same story. I mean, pretty much all the glaciers that we've been documenting have been disappearing very, very dramatically.
Yeah, and the film is it basically recounts, or not recounts, I mean, it's in real time, what's involved in setting up not so much remote cameras, but timed cameras so that
right.
they take these time-lapse pictures in the most sort of inhospitable locations for such an activity.
Absolutely, yeah. And we all, you know, everybody has seen time lapses. We think of time lapses. There are so many movies that have time lapse in them. But what James was trying to do, these cameras needed to withstand multiple years of shooting in negative 40 degree temperatures and 200 mile an hour winds. And there are, like, the winters are pitch black and there's no sunlight. And how do you have a solar-powered system last an entire winter, multiple winters, when there's no daylight to keep the camera running? James literally had to invent this camera system, and it was very, very difficult. It was one of the most difficult parts of the whole project. And fortunately, we were able to capture that and tell that story of how difficult it was. James is not an electronics person. He hates electronics. And so for him, this was a very, very big challenge.
Did his perspective, I mean, you know, by the end of the film, we see him going around with this project. And he's, I guess, by the end, he's actually sent by NASA to a conference as a representative. Did his perspective on this change? I mean, he says that, you know, 20 years ago he was a skeptic, but it seemed that, and I don't know if it was just a function of the way that you cut the film, but by the end, he's talking more about the implications of climate change
right.
For his kids. Did he become more, I guess, emotionally attached to that, that aspect of the issue as he started to see more of the evidence?
Yeah, you know, I think it's certainly for myself as well and any of the members of the team, you know, we've always heard that climate change was an issue peripherally, but the experience that we had, the experience that James had, and the degree to which we learned not just about the glaciers, but about the whole science in this process. I mean, this, James talks about this as being the single biggest issue that humanity will have to face. And we're at a turning point right now where we still have an opportunity to mitigate and minimize the worst of the damage of climate change. But we know that the consequences are going to happen. We are already experiencing the consequences of climate change. You know, I grew up on Staten Island, and my grandmother had a house for 50 years that was hit really, really hard with Sandy, flood water up to the mailbox. And that is what the scientists have been telling us for decades, is what the consequences of climate change would be, that events like Sandy are going to happen with greater frequency, with greater intensity. And to ignore this issue is really, it's not a matter of protecting the environment or saving the planet. It's a matter of, like, protecting and stabilizing the environment that we depend on, the conditions on the planet that we rely on as human civilization for our livelihood. You know, if plant areas, crop areas all around the country start to shift, we have huge implications of where food gets produced. When drought conditions happen, like, that has huge implications on food production. The drought was so bad this year. You know, the climate change affected so many different areas of American life this year, but we hear about it the most with Sandy.
Right.
The drought was so bad that food production dropped to a point where we had to start feeding our livestock in America ice cream sprinkles just because we ran out of corn and other crops to feed our cows. We're feeding them literally sprinkles just to give them calories so that they can stay alive. And the implications are massive, but they're huge. And the you know, I don't know how we want to look at it, but America, we fortunately have the financial resources to adapt to a lot of the consequences of climate change. When we have wildfires and hurricanes and tornadoes, and these disasters hit us harder than in other places around the world, but there are many, many countries that don't have the financial resources to relocate their populations, as they've already announced that they've had to do. We know that there are going to be millions of climate refugees as a result of being forced to leave their land and the political implications.
Let me, one of the things that I found really fascinating, I mean, what is interesting about your film is that it reflects that agenda that Balog had of showing the effects of climate change rather than, you know, sort of providing a bunch of statistics. Although, with that said, I thought the stuff about how glaciologists, or I don't know who was, that they take a core sample of these glaciers and that the glaciers basically, it's almost like sediment, isn't it? Like there's different layers of recorded history essentially in this ice. Mm-hmm. Of
isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
Millions of years. It was fascinating. And it was also a great way to discuss sort of, you know, how we can measure the changes in how much atmospheric carbon dioxide is in the air.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, people often say, well, there are natural cycles, and these things, they come and go, and huge shifts like this happen over time. And there's truth to that. That's why that has continued to be discussed. The real point is that the scientists are telling us that, yes, there are natural cycles, but climate change is happening right now where carbon dioxide and temperature levels are rising faster. They're accelerating faster than they ever have in recorded history, and that we are now 40% higher than carbon dioxide has ever been in the last million years, certainly long beyond humans ever walked on the planet. The interesting thing is that it's coming from this record that you're referencing. There are actually many different ways that they can corroborate this information. It comes from sea samples and coral reef samples and other ways that it's coming from the ocean. But one of the most distinct ones and one of the most accurate ones are these ice core samples that the scientists have discovered. And simply put, every single winter, when it snows another huge amount of snow every winter in Greenland and Antarctica and in other places, it basically adds another layer, just like a tree ring. And so they can very accurately drill a core, and they get a cross-section of the glacier, and they can see year after year after year what happened on the ice. And trapped in those layers of snow are tiny little air bubbles. And because of those air bubbles, they can measure precisely what year it was when that snow layer fell. And they can also measure the ratio of carbon dioxide and oxygen and other gases and molecules that are trapped in those tiny little air bubbles. That's absolutely fascinating to me. And so they know very precisely every year for the past million years what the planet looked like, how much carbon dioxide was in the planet. And it's interesting, it's kind of a more complicated science that they do, but because of the ratio of those different molecules, they know what the temperatures were on the planet during those years, because there are only certain ratios that can happen based on certain temperatures on the planet. So they now have this million-year-long record, and you see the cycle. It goes up and down and up and down, and it warms and it cools, and we have warm periods, and then we have ice ages. And now we are in a period where they were expecting us to go into a cooling, but we're not. We are like rising meteorologically, like it's like a literally like a meteor just skyrocketing off this graph, where we are now today 40% higher than it's ever been in recorded history over those million years, as far as the record can go back to the ice core record, the million year long record, and we're on track to go up to 500 parts per million. So the consequences of this level of CO2 rise, I mean, it is really, really dire if things continue to go as projected, because we're talking about planetary conditions, changes to the planet that, I mean, no human being has ever lived through. We're talking about borderline, you know, with the dinosaurs lived through. I mean, actually, that might be a slight exaggeration. I have to rescind that one just from a scientific perspective, but the consequences are very significant in terms of how warm the temperatures are going to get. But it's really the core point there is it's not just a matter of temperature itself explicitly rising. You know, we saw in my grandmother's lifetime, you know, I'm 28 years old right now, sorry. And in my grandmother's lifetime, roughly, sea level has risen about 8 inches. And if somebody is born today, in their lifetime, sea level is going to rise anywhere from 3 feet to 6 feet. And those predictions are considered to be lower and lower in terms of being a safe prediction for the next 100 years or so. And so when we look at how sea level rise has affected natural disasters in the last 100 years, we don't need huge sea level changes to have impact on effects like Sandy, on events like Sandy. We're going to see bigger and bigger natural disasters, bigger hurricanes, bigger storms as a result of this rising sea level. And right. that's exactly what the scientists have been warning about.
And I should say that in terms of going back to the notion that we are now 390 parts per million and heading right. to 500, just to contextualize that, when we talk about Bill McKibben's organization, 350.org, that is where right. it's perceived right. that this could be that we could be sustainable in terms of. But
yeah,
and so let me ask
that's
you.
That's what the scientists tell us is sustainable. You're right, 350 parts per million, and that's really the goal, to get us back down to 350 parts per million. That's what the scientists tell us we need to do.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's not what the political leadership has accepted as truth.
And so let me ask you this in terms of, you know, I mean, obviously, and perhaps it became more of a motivation as you went along with this project, both for you and for Balog. But, there is research that shows that that people tend to turn off when they start to see crisis messages. This is a big dilemma for all the people who are sort of trying to get the word out about this. And it, I mean, frankly, it's a crisis. And, you know,
it's a slow motion catastrophe. That's one of the sad things about it, because it happens over such a long period of time that we don't recognize what we're doing.
And it's also hard insofar as like getting people to sort of perceive it as, I mean, I used to have debates with a co-host on my program a while back, and she was like, well, I don't understand how people can, you know, everybody's kids are going to go through this, but I imagine that a certain percentage of people, their response is, well, I'm just going to make sure that my kids have the resources to, you know, mitigate the implications of all this. We're going to move up to a gated community up north or whatever it is. What, just as you go around with the film, as you've been presenting it to people, just give me your thoughts on that in terms of what you perceive needs to happen for people to not just gain awareness to it, but appreciate the fact that they have to act upon it.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really ties into what our core approach to the film was. You know, as we're talking about this thing, we are talking about a lot of the facts and the figures and the information around the issue. But, you know, Chasing Ice is not a very science-heavy film. When James Balog came up with the idea to do time-lapses, his reason was to do visual representation of what's going on and to take it away from facts and figures and to try and make it emotional so people can understand in their heart and in their gut what's happening. So his concept for his photography is what we carried over into the film itself, and we tried to make the film as visual as possible. It's actually, there's like as little science in the movie as I could possibly get away with. It's really the adventure story and the experience, this epic adventure. I think of James as kind of a modern Indiana Jones, you know, where he's going out into the world, and he's collecting this evidence and collecting this imagery and this information, and he's bringing it back for the public. And we get to follow him on these expeditions, these places that nobody ever gets to go to. So we were really trying to frame the film as that experience. You know, we're not trying to just present science here, and it's as little science as we can get away with. So that's how we really tried to frame the film. And what we've learned is that there are people who go and they go to see the movie because they heard it was beautiful. And they were skeptical about climate change, or they were skeptical about how important it was or how big of an issue it was. And they go and they see the film, and they come out and they tell us, you know, that the film shifted their opinion, that it really had a difference on the way they look at the issue, because they could finally understand it in an emotional way now, and they can wrap their head around it. We did a screening for 350 high school students in Utah. And during the Q&A, this one girl asked me what I thought the impact of the film would be. And it was very early. I didn't have any real sense of how people or how audiences would respond. So I just asked all those kids, for how many of you did the film shift your opinion around climate change? And literally 3/4 of these kids raised their hands. And they were telling us all sorts of things afterwards, that, you know, my uncle has no idea what he's talking about, and he just keeps arguing these points that he hears on the news, or hears, you know, continued on different radio programs and things like that. And these kids were telling us that they want their uncle, they want their cousin to see the movie, because it's finally something that they'll understand. So that's how we were trying to approach it, through James's story and through this adventure and through the imagery and evidence that he's collected. You know, it is something where we do need to do something about this issue. It's not something that we can let continue forever, because the consequences are too significant. But if people don't care about it, if they don't believe it in their heart that we need to do something, then we're never going to make any progress.
Well, I got to say, the film is beautiful, and it is really emotional in that respect.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I've seen
we're so thrilled that we have the opportunity to get it out in theaters. You know, right now it's still playing at Cinema Village and at Lincoln Center in Manhattan, and that's where we opened the film 2 weeks ago. And it's been held over just because people have been wanting to see the film. And,
so, you know, it's going to go beyond the 22nd. When is it available in New York? So it's going to go beyond the 22nd.
It's going to continue. It was because of the success of last weekend. It's going to continue beyond the 22nd. It's going to stay there over Thanksgiving weekend. So it'll be there to, I guess, the 29th. And if it does well this week, you know, we're competing against Skyfall and Lincoln.
Right.
You know, those are films that have these huge astronomical budgets. And this was a real independent project that was funded by friends and family. And we kept it independent the whole way. And we've just been amazed by the response to the film. And people really want to go see the film. And like you were talking about, people want to see it on the big screen. They want that experience in the big screen. So, you know, we're really, really thrilled that it's had this successful run. It's expanding. It's going wider and wider all around the country. Our website, chasingice.com, has all the screenings listed there, all the cities that we're going to.
I should just say next week, next week is going to be, or I guess starting this week in San Francisco, L.A., in Denver, in Brooklyn next week as well, Berkeley. And so we will put a link up at majority.fm. So, folks, over the weekend, if you're in New York or in D.C., and you have the opportunity to go to see a movie, go see this one, because A, I know that you'll enjoy it, but B, you'll also help keep it around in the theaters. And it's definitely something I'm going to try and check out in the theater, because it really is it's a beautiful film. It's very dramatic. It's footage. You know, you guys captured the largest calving incident in the history of visual representation. And
we filmed the largest calving that's ever been documented. And we're all used to seeing pieces of ice break off and crash into the water. You know, we've seen lots of those clips on the news and everything. The event that we filmed took 75 minutes for it to happen. This glacier retreated over a mile in that period of time, and it's literally the size of Lower Manhattan breaking off into the ocean and crumbling before your eyes. And that's something that
At that moment, was it just the three of you? I mean, they're the two guys who are there.
It was just two of us, actually. Yeah, it was me.
Oh, wait,
and
so you're one of those guys?
Yeah. I was behind the camera for almost all of it, because we weren't planning on using any of that footage or any of that story of us going there. So I'm not in any of the footage, but it was me and Adam that whole time.
Wow.
We camped in Greenland for a month waiting to capture something like this. And it was one of the most tedious, boring expeditions we had ever done. And the two of us, me and Adam, maintained a 24-hour vigil of the cameras. We had eight-hour shifts, and we were up together for 8 hours, and I was up for 8 hours, and he was up for 8 hours, and we did that day after day after day. And amazingly, on day 17, while we were on a phone call with James, checking in with him, telling him that nothing was happening and that we were still just waiting, very bored and waiting, on that phone call, the glacier started to calve. It started to roll over, and we told him, James, we'll call you back. And it just kept rolling for the next 75 minutes, and that's one of the climax things in the film.
Yeah, it's really impressive. Well, Jeff Orlowski, congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sam. Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with a couple of stories. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call at 646-257-3920. Like I say, this is the famous I will help you deal with your relatives at Thanksgiving. I don't know. You know, I can't help you with any type of, like, very specific personal problems that you have. Your dad's a jerk, whatever. Your mom doesn't love you. Your sister, you know, she's between the meth problem. There's nothing I can do about that. But if you have a right-wing relative, I might be able to give you a little bit of advice. Or if your dad's a jerk, I could probably help you with those. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
People get Larry. It's not very pretty.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Got an IM asking me what's wrong with my hair, and so we have shut down the Sammy Cam.
Everything that could go wrong today is going wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. We lost the stream for a bit, and then for some reason, we lost Ustream. That could have been a function of my hair. I mean, folks, I want to tell you, I left here yesterday immediately after ending the show early. I passed out for 3 hours. Then I had to go do some ADR for Bob's Burgers. That's right. And then I went back home, and after the longest subway ride in the history of... Yeah, it was, you know, like one of those things like, oh, the N and the R, it never stops between stops. And it did that time. And it was completely like, so like a 6:35, whatever the peak rush hour was. It was jam-packed in there. And then I slept from 7 o'clock last night till 7:30 this morning. Came back in here early to, the Sammy Cam is in not good shape.
You could listen to it for audio. The audio is working, but for some reason, you stream the videos down.
We don't know.
Little breaking news. It looks like there's a ceasefire agreement taking place in Gaza and Israel.
Oh, that's good. So we knew that a ceasefire supposedly was imminent as of yesterday, and then it broke down. Now it's back up. So that is good. That is good. I'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920. I'll take them a little bit early. Maybe we even do a freebie Wednesday today.
Sounds good to me.
You know, so that you folks, you're driving home. Look at what I give to you. Look at all I do is give. That's also a refrain I'm sure you're going to hear from your father when you get home, right? All I do is give.
So we're preparing you for it.
Folks, you know, it always stinks to lose an election. Back in college and in high school, I ran for student government, and I lost some. I won some. As a sophomore, I lost student government president in college by 12 votes. That hurt. I ended up winning again as a senior, but it would have been a junior and a senior. One of the first times that ever happened, but whatever. My friend, John Benjamin, who also happened to go to school with me at that time, the voice of the Majority Report, forgot to vote that day with a couple other of my friends. I mean, I don't know how you forget to vote in that type of situation when your best friend is running. For something like that, it seems to me a little bit more of the issue. But that's not the point. The point is, it stinks to lose an election. It stinks also when you've worked on an election and you lose it. But if you worked for Linda McMahon in Connecticut, as she ran for Senate, it stinks even more. After complaining to a local news station about not getting paid after Election Day, worker for Connecticut Senate candidate Linda McMahon's campaign say they were given checks that bounced. It's like working at Air America. One worker said he got a bad check and a condom. Quote, checks have been mailed to campaign workers. Replacement checks were issued for those who did not wait for the mail. Campaign spokeswoman Kate Duffy told WTNH. The original checks were voided once replacement checks were issued. And another guy, Twain Don Gomes, said basically a campaign staffer handed me a check with a condom in it. Told me I was screwed. That's the rudest gesture you could ever do to a person. It's like spitting in a person's face. Do you think that this type of behavior, this attitude, has anything to do with, like, the fact that she was engaged in WWE for so long, right? I mean, come on.
I can tell you she is not hard up for cash. So they should find her and get their money.
Yeah, this is reminiscent of those Romney campaign workers who had their credit cards turned off before they could even get into a cab to go home after their loser celebration.
WrestleMania just sold like $10 million worth of tickets, and the event is still like 6 months away. So she's not hard up for money.
Well, there you go. Linda McMahon also apparently has a lot of condoms. Also has a lot of condoms. This is a wonderful, heartwarming story. Where is that piece I had? You know, we've talked many times about how the Masters of the Universe. Hold on one second, sorry. Bear with me, folks. Been a tough day for me. Here's an audio of Lloyd Blankfein, who, of course, is the CEO and chairman of Goldman Sachs. You remember Goldman Sachs. They're the ones who just coincidentally, because all of their buddies were in the government when the banks crashed, came out doing quite well for themselves. Here's audio of him on, what was this, 60 Minutes the other night? Scott Pelley?
Some CBS show.
Yeah, I think it was Scott Pelley. One of those news shows.
Taking a break from doing God's work.
Yes, here it is.
Subject that politicians don't want to talk about.
You're going to have to undoubtedly do something to lower people's expectations, the entitlements, and what people think that they're going to get, because they're not going to get it.
Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
Some things. And, you know, you could go back and you can look at the history of these things. And Social Security wasn't devised to be a system that supported you for a 30-year retirement after a 25-year career. So there'll be certain things that, you know, the retirement age has to be changed. Maybe some of the benefits have to be affected. Maybe some of the inflation adjustments have to be revised.
Hold
but in
on,
general,
pause it for a second. First off, who is it that's working for 20, 25 years and then retiring for 30 years? The only people that I've heard about are doing that, who get a pension after 20, 25 years, are cops and firefighters. They don't get their Social Security till they're 65, 66, 67, depending on when they're going to retire anyways. This is just absurd. He's lying. You have to lower people's expectations. Over 50% of Americans rely on Social Security for 50% of their income in retirement. So you're talking an average of $1,400 a month. So this millionaire whose bank was bailed out by the United States government is saying that these people, you know, the expectations that you're going to have, you know, $2,000 a month as a senior citizen to live off of, we got to lower people's expectations in that way.
To retire at a 25-year career and be ready for Social Security when you retire, that means you started your career at what, 40-something? 40-something? 40-something years old, yeah.
That's just absurd. He's lying. Continue.
Entitlements have to be slowed down and contained.
Because we can't afford them going forward?
Because we can't afford them.
Yeah, it's a complete lie. You know, every rich person who's a dick is coming out of the woodwork now because they see this as an opportunity, this whole potential for a grand bargain, as an opportunity to cut social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare. Opportunities like this don't come around too often for them, so they're really, really doing their best to take it. When in fact, A, it has nothing to do with the deficit, and B, we don't want to close the deficit. We want to spend more at a time of decreased demand in the private sector. So, I don't know. All I can say is, Lloyd, F you. And also, this coming from Felix Salmon via Digby. The federal deficit has fallen faster over the past 3 years than it has in any such stretch since demobilization from World War II. In fact, outside of the post-World War II era, the only time the deficit's fallen faster was when the economy relapsed in 1937, turning the Great Depression into a decade-long affair. If U.S. history is any guide, we are already testing the speed limits of fiscal consolidation that doesn't risk backfiring. That's why the best way to address the fiscal cliff is to likely postpone it. Well, it's not just Felix Salmon who's saying postpone the fiscal cliff. Apparently, Deepak Chopra is too, but hold on. Let's go to the phones. Bob from Albany, welcome to the program, Bob.
Hi, I did that. I mean, I worked for less than 19, saving for retirement. I saved less than 19 years, and in that time, I was able to save enough to be able not ever to have to work.
Well, but I mean, you didn't draw Social Security at that point.
No. I mean, it's just privately, because what I did was I maxed out, and then I'm more than maxed out. They had these fixed annuities, so I was able to get a 3% guarantee.
Yeah.
I mean, just the high rates above 8%, and in 2000, and then everyone was saying the market was too high, so I moved all the money out of the stocks and into the fixed income at 8%. But anyway,
wait a second, Bob. Hold on for a second, Bob. Wait a second, Bob. You got to tell me how to do this.
Well, first you don't you live single in a tiny apartment and you don't spend a lot of money.
Right.
You make a six-figure income and you save basically almost a third of it. So you save one third of your money. You're living on two thirds of your money. If you want to replace two thirds of your money, right, and live like a little less than that, then you only need a goal of half. You need a let's say you were making $100,000, right?
Yeah.
And you're living on. It's going to be 60,000, okay?
Yeah.
Then if you want to replace, like, two-thirds of income, your target is only replacing $40,000 worth of income. So what you do is you have a very low low target to hit. You save a boatload of money, and you just live on nothing, basically, like I did. Live in a tiny studio, you know. And then, you know, just save every cent you got, but most people are human beings and not like me.
Yeah.
But the other thing,
that's
but
the problem.
Nice,
my wife.
I'm sorry?
That would have been my game plan, but my wife, she won't let me do that.
Yeah. Well, wives and children are very expensive because they have
tell
different
me.
Ideas about how to live.
But, yeah. But get you sick too.
Concerning Blankfein's complaint about the entitlements.
Yeah.
He's only half right. You can only cut the Social Security because it's a definite amount. You can't cut benefits for Medicare because the problem with Medicare is that doctors are inefficient and they're way overpaid. The people who have to take a hit would be the doctors. Doctors' income didn't increase until we instituted Medicare because all of a sudden people had a system to look for to design the Blue Cross systems. That was the same time that all these people start getting Blue Cross Blue Shield plans that were mimicked on a indemnity plan, meaning it's a third-party pay. You go to the doctor charges whatever he thinks is reasonable, and the insurance company will pay, you know, the minimum or what's customary, reasonable, and, you know, average or whatever. Well, Medicare set up this entire system of how much to pay each doctor for everything, and there were no private insurance companies. There was only Blue Cross Blue Shield, who took everyone. They didn't do any underwriting, meaning it was just like a single-payer system. And all of a sudden, there was this huge money going in to pay for doctor bills. The Blue Cross plan was a payment system for hospitals, and it started in the Great Depression when hospitals were going broke because people had no money to pay. So they decided, let's set up this nonprofit system that will allow people to prepay for hospital care. And you can find this on the internet. You can look up the history of Blue Cross Blue Shield. You can see that's when they were founded, during the Great Depression. Blue Shield was like Medicare Part B to pay for doctors' charges, which weren't covered by Blue Cross. So what wound up happening is that this system inflated prices, and doctors were able to charge higher and higher rates. Doctors' incomes didn't really become really large until Medicare in the 60s, and it's just been getting higher and higher, greatly outpacing the rate of inflation and everyone else's wages at the exact same time that the cost of health care as a percent of GDP went from 6, 7, 8 all the way now to 16% of GDP. It's doctors have been making a killing. I mean, we're paying more than twice what everyone else in the world is paying, and if insurance companies only take 18% off the top, it's still, they're almost getting twice the amount. You can't get anywhere unless you lower doctors' incomes, and no one's willing to say that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's very hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, I mean that's it's an issue. I mean, there's supposedly going to be a shortage of primary care doctors in 15 years or so. Yeah, so it's a problem. I think one of the things that that the Affordable Care Act at least tries to deal with is that panel that provides for
eating care.
Yeah,
good care versus bad care. They have these accountable care organizations. I mean, I took an entire graduate course a year and a half ago on this when I was up in Canada. They had this health economics course.
I got to drop you, buddy. Your phone's not in great shape today. But thanks. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
Bye. Jeremiah, what's going on?
Oh, wait a minute. Wait, I got you. Okay. Hello, Sammy. I hope you're feeling better.
Feeling a little bit better. I still got the sweats, but at least I'm standing.
I wanted to send you these raviolis. They would have helped you. I wanted to send them, but nobody got back to me. I got the greatest raviolis, Sammy, I found in the store. Oh, they're so good.
Jeremo, I don't know that I have never heard raviolis as something that you eat when you have a cold.
It helped me. I'm a lot better. Listen, I think Bob needs a glass of wine. He's really got to spend a little money, man. Come on, keep the economy going.
Ben, all right, well, where are you going for Thanksgiving, Jeremo?
I'm going up to Hancock, New York.
All right.
Going to see my father-in-law.
How's that going to be?
My poor father-in-law. What's that? We're leaving tomorrow morning.
No, how's that going to be? Is it going to be uncomfortable, or do you get along with your father-in-law?
Sammy, my father-in-law doesn't give two shits about anything but his TV and his football games and his sports. That's all he cares about.
Well,
he says the rest of it's a bunch of crap. And here's a guy that's got 2 master's degrees.
Well, maybe that's what happens when you get that second master's degree. You realize that it's all a bunch of crap. All right, well, have a great Thanksgiving, Jeremo.
Wait a minute, Sammy. Just real quick. I saw your movie, and I can't find it now. The one where you play Lieberman?
Oh, yeah, Situationist, yeah.
Sammy, I enjoy that movie tremendously. I really, really enjoy that movie. You know, it's... You know, I wish people would talk about it more. I went on your blog. Well, I went on Facebook, Jari Report, but nobody wants to talk about it. It's a great movie.
Well, just give it time. I'm sure at one point it'll be respected for the piece of work that it is.
I think so too. Thanks, Sammy.
Bye,
have a great holiday.
You too.
Take care, buddy.
Bye. Let's go to the IMs. Man, I still got the sweats bad. Sammy Cam is back. Black screen, no audio. This is missing link. Left Coast Marcus. Not sure what's happened, but I can't listen to the webpage. Blah, blah, blah. Yes. Since I am watching the Sammy Cam, what happened to your hair? Does it look bad? Haircut? A little flattened?
It's a little flat. It's not that big of a deal. Again, there seems to be this weird audience focus on your hair.
Well, you know. So the caller's key to success. Divorce my wife, disown my children, get a job that pays $100,000 a year, live like a pauper, and invest my money in fixed 8% savings. Cue the lonely goat herd. By the way, I know you are sensitive about losing your high school presidential election. Just kidding about the hair. Well, look, I didn't lose the high school presidential election. High school, I ran for vice president and treasurer, and I won. It was as a sophomore, I ran for student government president, and I lost.
When you were talking about losing before, and then you brought up Benjamin, for a second I was like, you lost to Benjamin? I can't picture Benjamin being the type of person who runs for anything like that.
No, that would be horrible. Good interview today. Now we just need to connect this conversation to the one on energy independence. 100 years worth of oil in the ground. We could have 2,000 years of free oil under the ground. The fact remains that we can't burn it because of climate change. Bob had me at step one, earn six figures. Indeed. Anoush, happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for so much for your show. Listening to since Air America last few years, tough and graphic design. Haven't been able to contribute, but things to be looking up greatly. Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, I have to say that during when we were doing Break Room Live, and during Break Room Live, I think we did a thing like Unemployee of the Month where we talked about who, you know, had lost their job. And people in graphic design, more than anything else, seem to be just taking a beating during the financial crash. I don't know what it was, but it was that was when I basically said, like, we're going to make sure my daughter is not a graphic designist, because that seems to be like a harder job than being an actor.
Well, because when it hits the fan, I mean, do you need to get rid of your programmers who make everything run? No. Do you get rid of the business people who help maximize your profits?
Right.
No. But you get rid of the guy who makes everything look nice.
Right. Well, good luck, Anoush. They hire all interns. Yeah. Yeah, horrible. I mean, I know that feeling. 2010 was a pretty bad year for me. And it really is, it's depressing. It's depressing. Bush and Chains. Sorry I'm missing today's show. Can't seem to get Majority Report's website on my phone. I am determined to get a to get an app, and I'm having a meeting with a guy.
Bush and Chains, if you know anybody who makes an app.
No, I got a guy.
And doesn't
lined
take
up.
Gold.
I've got a guy lined up. We'll do this. By the way, can someone ask Meg Whitman how a $3.5 billion company can have a $6 billion write-down? Oops. Looks like HP is the Twinkie. So much for the CEO president, right? How much did she spend in California? $150 million of her own money? See, we need to use this. We need to be a country needs to be a company. Both start with C. Company. Country. Understand? CEO. K-E-O. I just said it that way because you don't, when you say C like that, it sounds like an S. Isn't that weird? K sounds like K. C sounds like an S. I'm gonna mention that to Laura.
I was in California in 2010, right before that election, and there was this interview where Meg Whitman was talking about how when she first came to California, it was the state of limitless opportunity and blah, 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 blah. And they immediately – Jerry Brown's people immediately cut this ad where they just played that clip. And then it was like, who was governor when Meg Whitman was coming to California for limitless opportunity? Jerry Brown. And it was just – they seemed like – that was what it was like. She would have 50 ads up. They were all terrible and bland, and she'd be own-goaling herself. And then Jerry Brown would have, like, one ad that was a lot more effective. So that's how he was able to spend, like, a third of the money, win that race.
CEO president. Oh, good. Sam's thinking points just came over the Likudnik wire. All hail calculated risk. Just an added bonus. A jab at zero hedge. Now you'll know how to think. I got to read this. All hail calculated risk. Change some word. Bizarrely, some people thought I was attacking Joe Wise and thought I was praising him. Since I've mentioned both the nonsense that passes for economic analysis at CNBC and how Joe Wiesenthal gets attacked when he makes sense, I would highlight this Joe Wiesenthal interview with Bill McBride, a.k.a. Calculated Risk. It's a great piece, and I'm not saying this because McBride has nice things to say about me. Even better, he shows appropriate contempt for zero hedge. Ooh.
I thought you liked zero hedge.
No, who did? Krugman?
No, not Krugman.
Yes, well, that's why. This is the Likudnik wire.
Oh, I see.
Likudnik wire. I love it. He's not on. Can't even talk to him. He's not on. Buzz Hoff. Hope you're feeling better today, Sam. Another informative show. Feels like I'm earning a degree from Sam Senior University. Have a good holiday. We like to party here. Oh, Bush and Chain says, now I can hear you. Well, I just read the, I just pulled my tear sheet off the Likudnik wire. I had a mind meld with, I've met that Joe Wiesenthal guy, I think. Good guy. Very smart. Very smart about how much he knocked Zero Hedge. And I'm joking. Okajik. Hi, Sam. Ree Bob. He's not like most people because he had a six-figure salary. Also, I don't know of any investment that safely pays 8%. More power to him, though. He said something about a fixed annuity. Maybe back in 2000, you could get those for 8%. I got out of, I got out of the market with a chunk of change back in 2007 and got into a structured CD, which is a very interesting financial vehicle that I still like. Basically, is FDIC insured. The interest rate is a function of how much the market moves up or down. Doesn't matter. And as long as it stays within certain parameters, less than 25%, more than 25%, or more than 18%, or less than 18%, you get that rate. It's pretty good. Your broker won't tell you about it because they don't get much money for that. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. My father-in-law keeps asking my wife and me if we've bought any freeze-dried food yet. Well, you know, I'll tell you something. Based on Sandy, it's probably not a bad idea to have a couple of things of freeze-dried food, just in general. But I wouldn't worry about buying enough to last like 2 years. A Square, Sam, Matt, Michael, we fought many battles these past 2 years. Public opinion, Occupy, GOP, crazy primary election, the ongoing grand bargain. But we now must focus on our greatest one. Battle cry music, please.
Charge.
The war on Christmas. We must fight to wish folks happy holidays, not Merry Christmas. Fight to take down baby Jesus in the Three Kings display from government offices and public schools, unless they have a Hanukkah and Kwanzaa candles. We desperately need new recruits for this war, so I wrestled some daughters for my dear husband, who is an active Majority Report moocher, to send you the cost of one Majority Report membership. Oh, thank you. Folks, this holiday, let's get at least one new Crusader, I mean member, with the fervor of Jermo, the passion of Jimmy Reefer Cake, and the pockets of George Soros. Onward, indeed. Bartleby 141, breaking news, Sam. They've announced a ceasefire in Gaza. Happy Thanksgiving. Feel better. Yeah, that's good news. What do you mean? Not good news?
No, I mean, of course it's good news.
Why don't you pull that microphone closer to you? It always looks like, I mean, it hurts my back to see you strain like that.
I have a setup here. I have to lean over.
Yeah, it sounds better, though, when you're closer.
You like it when I'm closer?
Yeah.
All right.
Don't mumble more now, though.
I'm not mumbling.
Okay.
What was I talking about? What were you asking me about?
I don't remember.
The ceasefire is a good thing, but you've just had a week of violence that led to nothing. It's all, I mean, it's just an endless waste.
Yeah, as opposed to violence that doesn't go in vain.
And it doesn't happen. And it's, you know, it's depressing.
Of course. The whole thing is just there just doesn't seem to be a legitimate will for peace, you know, on either side to some degree. And I really do think that Bush really screwed this thing up bad. I think he just set set Israel on a horrible course by sort of empowering the worst elements of that country.
they need to be forced. They need the internal excuse to say, look, guys,
yes,
we need to do this, and it's not up to us. And the policy coming from us is the exact opposite. And,
that's,
you know,
correct.
Bush, sure, but, you know, it's pretty broadly distributed.
Defeatocrat, graphic designer here. Lucky to still have a job. Been looking for a better one for a year and a half. Barely a nibble. Hang in there. Parprog, how about the best of Sam's voices for members? C is for country. That's good enough for me. 767654. The HP thing is fishy to begin with. The management team for the company HP bought all quit after Meg came on board, and the head of that team is saying there's no way there was a huge irregularity like that. HP would have missed it during the due diligence. This is all trying to blame the former CEO and flush his projects down the toilet. He's saying HP has taken the write-down from all of their mistakes pre-Meg. They're trying to blame this acquisition. The FBI is investigating it now, and if Meg is signed off on this as being a fact, she could be in hot water. Vivian Huber. Hi, Sam. Got home early from work, and I wanted to wish you and your family happy Thanksgiving. Hope you're feeling better. Thanks so much. I am feeling a little better. Nikki sick, cough. Milo was sick, vomiting. Missing link. The concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere hit a high in 2011. Was reported yesterday. Chief among these heat-trapping gases is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide levels reached about 390 parts per million last year, which is 140% of the pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, and nearly 2 parts per million higher than the 2010 carbon dioxide level. The international body estimates about 400 billion tons of carbon that have been released in the atmosphere since 1750. I mean, that's the thing that was great in this film is that, first of all, it's fascinating that you have ancient air trapped in these air bubbles. I mean, it never really occurred to me, but of course, you see air bubbles all the time in ice, you know, and ice on the ground. And there doesn't seem to be any other opportunity for air to be trapped, right? I mean, it would just be ice. And it's layers and layers and layers, and they can actually measure this air. I mean, that's just fascinating to me. And the film is beautiful, but that part, and then it just you can just see the graph. It has to be man-made. Has to be. All right, let me read this Breitbart story. I know, folks. Maybe it'll inspire you if you have any questions on how to deal with your conservative relatives.
I would just put it this way, that if this is what they're coming armed with, you're in pretty good shape.
This is a Breitbart story by Joel Pollack. Is that guy, was he a comedy writer ever? Joel Pollack, he's one of the lead writers on Breitbart. Now remember, Breitbart.com has fallen apart. There's been a lot of stories of people arguing and infighting there because they don't have their guru anymore. But go ahead.
He is not a comedy writer, but in 2010, he did run for Congress in Illinois' 9th congressional district.
There he goes. So he's written something that is supposed to be funny. As a public service to our readers and a gesture towards civility in a national discourse, we offer you the following how-to guide for surviving your Thanksgiving dinner at the home of your triumphant liberal relatives. So here it is, folks. They know that their liberal brethren will probably be excited at the fact that one of the world's greatest douchebags, Mitt Romney, did not become president. Arrival. Your home looks lovely, almost like it's worth what you paid for it. Obama didn't help with that yet, did he? Oh, well, maybe next term. May I use your bathroom? Now, folks, the joke here is, of course, that even though there was a massive real estate bubble that crashed before Obama became president, he hasn't been able to reinflate the real estate market in some of the worst hit areas and around the country. And then the funny part is you say, can I use your bathroom? In the unlikely event that your host's home has appreciated in value, use this introduction instead. Love what you've done with it. Better dump it before the new year, though, or you might face that new Obamacare tax. Now, real estate taxes are issued by states. There are local taxes issued by states and localities. So when, if you're a conservative, you say this to your liberal friends and they look at you like, what the frick are you talking about? Understand, they're looking at you because you don't know what you're talking about.
Don't forget that little part in parentheses.
Wait until after dinner to make a lowball offer. Oh, this stuff is good. Or here's another greetings. Oh, Grandma, I'm so sorry about what Obama did to your Medicare. I tried to stop him. Well, I guess what Obama did was to cut down on the payments for those in Medicare Advantage, the providers. So Grandma would also look at you and was like, I don't know what you're talking about. That's all right. Come in. You're the strange one in the family. Here's another one. Little Johnny, all grown up, still looking for a job? Oh, there's always grad school, you know. I hear Obama will pay for your student loans.
That's when all grown up little Johnny will punch you in the face.
No, well, Johnny will say, well, at least I'm now on my parents' health insurance, dick. And the loans are only 3.25% as opposed to 6%. Jane, you look amazing. I bet you're the reason Obama promised free contraception.
Pretty sure you'll be shown to the door after that. No.
Well, I think at that point, really, Jane will say, you know, actually, that was the attitude that cost you a Senate race in Missouri and Indiana, you freaking moron. Hey, kids, let's watch some football. Whatever team Obama picked, that's the one going to lose. Ask Detroit. Yeah. Grace, I'm thankful that the war on women is finally over and you accepted a racist like me back into your midst. Well, I think that's legitimate. I'm thankful for Elizabeth Warren. Now that we have a Native American in the Senate, we can celebrate without feeling guilty anymore.
I get that one. It's because she's
she's part Native American.
Oh, so good.
I'd like to take a moment to remember those four brave Americans who lost their lives because of an anti-Islamic video. Well, I mean, I hope you're not mocking those four brave Americans. Blessed be Obama, for whom we enjoy this bountiful harvest. I can't do it. I can't read it anymore. I mean, this is... Oh, wait a second. Was this part of, like, how to write something unfunny competition?
Come on, keep going. It's good.
You know, to be fair, I imagine this guy whipped this off. I feel like I've spent more time in the bathroom than this guy did working on this piece. No turkey for me, thanks. The poultry industry is a major contributor to global warming, and I can't eat meat without thinking how I caused Hurricane Sandy. I'm not having cranberry sauce either. So many of our cranberries today are imported from Poland, and they supported Mitt Romney, you know. Well, now you know why these guys lost the election. Politics and comedy, not terribly different. You need to have a shared understanding of what you're talking about. Have some more pumpkin pie, please. I promise not to tell Michelle Obama because she suggests eating well. Oh, this is good. What? No more Twinkies this year? Departure. I can't believe it's time to go already. 4 hours and $600 million in national debt just flew by. Gan en jai kwai lei. That's happy Thanksgiving in Chinese. Might as well start learning. Oh, is this Red Dawn, right? Because it's Red Dawn. China's coming because of Red Dawn, right? Why didn't you come to our place next year? Seeing as how your taxes are going up in a few weeks, it's only fair. Well, I don't get it. Why wouldn't their taxes go up? What does that got to do with? Sorry, I parked you in. Oh, darn, I love the Chevy Volt today. You wouldn't have an extension cord, would you? Oh, wow, that is good stuff. Wow, that is really... You know, I think people know that I...
Because of how things work, this guy is totally going to get a pilot from some network.
No. You know, I spent a lot of time going back and forth with Breitbart back in the day. And I got to say that more than anything else, that's probably making him roll in his grave. He would have never allowed something that patently unfunny to be on the front page of his site. There was one thing that guy knew about was writing good fiction. Not good fiction, but decent fiction. They changed the bad guys in Red Dawn to North Korea. Studio got cold feet about dissing China. PF 1800 says, no, that's not what it is. Well, yes, I guess it could be the studio got cold feet, but they also want it to be sold in China. Who has to ask permission to use the bathroom at a family member's home? He suggests calling your sister or your aunt a slut. I think he's revealing why he's such a bitter guy. Indeed. Heathen Stephen, in Bush's voice, the Jews and the Palestinians just need to get together and resolve their differences like good Christians. Just everybody should just meet in church. Let Christ be their guide.
Wait, I had no idea they changed the Red Dawn from China to North Korea. They did, really?
Yeah. What did they do? CGI all the uniforms afterwards? It's like it doesn't matter.
But, I mean, how long is this movie? 5 minutes? What kind of threat is North Korea? I mean,
there's no chance that they were going to make it China. That's not going to happen.
It was originally China.
Yeah, but of course that wasn't going to happen for many reasons.
Why couldn't it be just some type of like...
Why didn't they switch it to like Russia? They're always good for villains.
Well, that was what the original one was, but they don't... You need to remake it. You need to do it over again. Bush and change. Soros just made a huge purchase into gold ETFs, by the way. You blew it when you cashed in your gold ETFs. I made a little bit of money from that. Well, Soros just bought gold ETFs. That means that I just bought gold ETFs. He pays off this show with gold ETFs. What are gold ETFs at now? What's gold at right now? Is it up? Okajik. Your father-in-law is worried about the coming race war. Yeah, I understand. And collapse of society. Well, there's a coming race war?
I'm still just trying to imagine this North Korean invasion. I'm just, it's hilarious.
Speaking of horrible course in Israel, when did everybody in the media, including you, start calling Benjamin Netanyahu Bibi? I always thought everybody did.
He's been called BB for his whole career, like since the 80s.
Yeah. B. Huber, I've been sick for about 10 days. I was exposed to pollution from storm. Work was flooded. Oy. They bring in molded paperwork. Was feeling better until I went to work. Yeesh. PF 1800, who has to ask for me? Oh, okay. That's true. Dradman Thieves. That's a good point about Bush's responsibility on Israel. If you recall, he basically just blew off the issue of peace negotiations in the region even before September 11th. It took him at least a year and a half into his administration to do anything at a higher level, and then it was the anemic roadmap. I cannot say I can point to anything helpful in Obama's done, though. I would agree with your assessment of Obama, but Bush didn't just sort of ignore the problem. Bush actively promoted and grew the problem. He pushed Israel to push and the Palestinians to have elections at a time where the where Fatah did not want to have elections because they didn't feel they were electorally strong enough. But somehow I think the Bush administration thought, okay, we can weaken all of the Palestinians by isolating Hamas. And of course, you know, the most cynical and stupid perspective on it, they also encouraged Israel to go into Lebanon and attack Hezbollah, as opposed to functioning as the brake on them when, you know, they would attempt to, you know, in the past, what would have happened is instead of responding, you know, based on domestic pressure to Hezbollah, the Israelis could say, you know, the Americans have come out and said stop, and you know, there was an understanding that we have to that in Israel that we're going to follow what the Americans say. I mean, so there was a lot of that.
He also accepted facts, what they call facts on the ground that had not been accepted before in terms of settlements. And the other thing, too, is that in fairness to Obama, who's not great on this, obviously, but he pushed in the beginning. He pushed to stop settlements. He pushed to have a freeze. And no one backed him up. And all he caught was political flack for it.
So yeah, you have to understand.
He's disengaging, but there's a context
right,
for it.
Right. I mean, you have to look at the Senate and the House now. I mean, it's just wall to wall Israel. You know, there is no questioning of Israel whatsoever. It's beyond. It's ridiculous. It's just utterly ridiculous.
No questioning of right wing Israel.
Right. I mean, didn't Bush back Fatah to attack Hamas and try a coup in Gaza?
Yes, I think so.
I think so.
And now. Gaza, Fatah is more popular than Hamas, and this attack gives Hamas a great opportunity to recreate its popularity by standing strong against this. So it's just
bad. I totally agree with the part in this Thanksgiving joke where they mentioned Detroit lost the World Series. Go San Francisco Giants, and happy Thanksgiving to Sam and the Majority Report team. Lucia. I'm still concerned about John Kerry being pulled out of the Senate. I think Scott Brown could easily win this seat, and if Democrats do manage to hold on, the new senator won't have the power connections that Kerry has. Do you think they're going to pick Kerry? I don't think so. I really hope President Obama thinks this through. Remember when he picked Napolitano to head the Department of Homeland Security? Many said we could get another Democrat elected and go, and look at how that turned out. John Kerry is definitely qualified as Secretary of State or Defense, but we need him in the Senate much more than we need him in Obama's cabinet. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Scott Brown will be tough to beat, I think, in a general election. I mean, in a special election. Remember in the original Red Dawn, many of the invaders were Nicaraguans. What? No, they were Cubans. Oh, really?
Wasn't it also like the Sandinistas? It was like the Russians, the Cubans, and the Sandinistas.
I don't remember that. Bush in chains. 725 approximately. Aren't we supposed to be at 2,500 at this point with gold? We're on the brink of the economy completely falling apart, of our fiat dollars being worth nothing, just being shreds of paper. How come we're not at 2,500? People are buying freeze-dried food. Shouldn't gold be at like $4,500 an ounce? Bartleby 141. Not sure if you mentioned already, but Krugman may have made his best blog post yesterday. Here's a small taste. Today's GOP is in an alliance between plutocrats and the preachers, plus some opportunists along for the ride. Full stop. The whole party is about low taxes at the top and low benefits for the rest, plus conservative social values and putting religion in the schools. It has no other reason for being. Remember in the original Red Dawn, Calhoun, many of the invaders were – remember what Reagan said in 1981? Nicaragua was only a two-day bus ride from the Rio Grande.
Did he really say that?
I guess so, yeah. So, folks, you got Black Friday coming. You know why they call it Black Friday, right, guys?
That's when retailers are in the black?
For the first time of the year. Now, we've been reporting on this coalition. It's not really a union. It's not a union. Unions are actual things. They have charters. They have specific rules, which... But workers at Walmart have organized to some extent, and they are planning on wildcat strikes on Black Friday. It has definitely scared Walmart. They are sending out, well, first off, they went to the National Labor Relations Board to block the strike as illegal, as an illegal union-based activity, because it's striking is happening not just at Walmart stores, but in other suppliers to Walmart, which would mean that it's a broader strike where you can't have unions striking across industries in support of each other. But the problem that they have with the NRLB, I think, is that these are not unions. So it remains to be seen. Although unions now are coming out, along with George Soros and Sam Cedar, and supporting these activities. Here is, got to give her some cred, Sue Costello on CNN, talking to a guy, a spokesperson from Walmart, who it would appear to me hasn't had to do many of these. I mean, he's well-spoken, but I don't know. I like the fact that he's not wearing a tie. He's trying to look like a regular American, but I don't know. $15,000 annually. That's what you earn at Walmart. It makes you guys look almost high paid in this place.
Almost.
Yeah. Almost.
This is another allegation. You know, the federal poverty level for a household of two is $15,130. The website Making Changes at Walmart lists the average salary for a Walmart employee at $15,500. That's just above the poverty line. Walmart made a whole lot of money last year. Billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars. Why not at least negotiate with them so that they can live a better middle-class lifestyle?
Well, first of all, we can't negotiate with the unions right now because none of our associates are unionized, and that's one of the things that we mentioned to the labor board last week when we filed a complaint against them. But we've got great associates. We appreciate our associates. We know they're going to do a great job for us this holiday season. We wouldn't be able to have the success that we've had of late without the hard work of our associates. And Black Friday is going to be awesome at Walmart. That's what we're focused on right now.
So the question is, you pay people just hundreds of dollars above the poverty line. Understand, Walmart employs about 1% of our workforce in this country. Walmart alone is the biggest employer. Why not negotiate with them? And his answer is, well, they're not a union, so we can't negotiate with unions. And our associates are great. Keep going.
So many of your employees are coming out and saying the working conditions, especially in Walmart's warehouses, aren't exactly pristine. They talk about no air conditioning in the summertime in very warm climates. They say they don't make enough money. They say their health care costs could rise 34% next year, and they just can't afford it on a $15,000 a year salary. Are all of those employees
complaining? Yeah, I would tell you, don't believe everything you read in a union press release, because, you know, there are not, you know, a large majority of associates that are speaking out. It's a few people, and it's the same people that the unions put up every year and have been doing it for years. So a lot of this is smoke and mirrors and is not having an impact. In fact, our associates have said to us, why aren't we speaking out more? Which is why I'm doing shows like yours and others to really get our message out, because we want our customers to know that they can count on us for low prices and a broad assortment of great items on Black Friday, just like they always have. Well, and that's what's really going on here.
Well, let me...
So here she says, well, you've got people complaining about working conditions, about their pay. Why aren't you doing anything about it? Well, and he said, don't believe that. In fact, our associates love working for us. In fact, our associates, those are the people who make the $15,000 annually, work on the floor at Walmart. came to us and said, why aren't you going out there on TV and telling people how great it is to work here? Because, you know, nobody working at a place in any way wants anybody to agitate for them to get paid more. Like, I'm sorry. Matt, Michael are in this office, fairly opinionated guys. And if there was someone who was agitating on the outside to pay these guys more, I find it hard to believe that you guys would be like, Sam, you should get out there and really talk about how great it is to work for you. And then if they did do that, I find it hard to believe that as soon as I left the office, they looked at each other and go, we had to say that, right? I mean, we had to continue.
Let me just ask you to address another charge that's out there. If their workers complain, Walmart retaliates against them.
Yeah, absolutely not. We have a very strict retaliation policy, anti-retaliation policy. And if any associates have those concerns, we want to hear about them and we'll address them and take action if there's merit to it. But again, the fact is this is a very small contingent of associates who are.
So in other words, if you've been retaliated against and you're still our employee, we want to hear about it. And
we will take swift action against you.
We promise to write your name down. And don't worry about a thing. If there's any retaliation, we have a very strict retaliation policy.
I love the in the part before the last part. I love how he was talking about how the employees were telling, you know, someone who works for one of the Walmart bigwigs need to go out there and, you know, defend us, tell us how we love working there. So this guy says that's what he's here for, and then he starts discussing what great deals they'll have on Black Friday.
Right.
Being, you know, propped up by the unions to make these kind of claims. The vast majority of our associates like working at Walmart. They like the opportunities they get by working there, and they're ready to serve our customers on Black Friday, period.
The vast majority of them. That could be 700,000 of the 1.1 million. Who knows? But Black Friday, you can. We'll have a link at majority.fm where you can go to find out what is taking place near you to protest if you're interested.
Don't believe the union press release, folks. No. Believe the Walmart Black Friday circular.
Indeed. Jay Tingle, I'm very pleased that you're considering going with an app for the show. I would contribute to such a venture and imagine other listeners would as well. Why not try one of your informal fundraisers? I'm thinking about that, yeah. They call it Black Friday because that's the day Obama hands out free phones to his base. We know who those people are. Left Coast Marcus, we want to hear from our employees so we know who to take out behind the dumpster and put the boots on. Pushing chains. Yes, we should be over 2K. Why? Market manipulation from JPM and the Fed. Educate yourself about precious metals and you know what the hell is going on. Organized labor is feared by every fascist regime. The U.S. is no different. Parprog. The one bit of information we might get out there of this latest violence is how Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood is going to try and affect the situation in Israel-Palestine. I mean, I got to imagine, you know, having them. I mean, so far, I don't know. It's very difficult to tell. But so far, I think it's got to be a positive, right? I mean, that they have a little bit more credibility, I would think, on some level.
Marcy's been strengthened by his role in this because he's sort of like an indispensable negotiator at this point. And he's perceived as, you know, they're close to Hamas. And they're going to play a really important role moving forward, and that's just the reality of
it. And to a certain extent, we needed to rejigger the balance because the problem is that without America as a countervailing force, Israel's baser instincts, essentially, were allowed to go unchecked. And so you need to redistribute now that we have a redistribution of the sort of the power dynamic, at least – to some degree, it's helpful, I think. 76754. It was Cubans with Russian advisors. The main bad guy in the town, in the town's name was Ernesto, and he consulted constantly with his Soviet puppet master. PF1800. If the Walmart associates do such a great job, why doesn't Walmart reward them with higher pay? You know, PF1800. You can read all the union flyers you want to read and all the ideas that you have about communism and Obamamanism. Dr. Adamanthes, wait a minute. Weren't they saying by implication if Detroit are losers, then San Francisco latte drinking liberals are winners? Indeed. All right, folks. Well, that is our we'll do one more. Final IM of the day. Parprag, agreed. Morsi has the potential to be dangerous, but it's better than more Mubarak. Indeed. Folks, we're going to have a show on Friday. It'll be an interview I did for Ring of Fire with Bill Black, and then we'll also include an archive show for you members. Have a great Thanksgiving. See you next Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?